tonight. So with that, let's take a look a little bit at the fifth aliyah of Parshas Kisetze. So the fifth aliyah has two sections to it. It's not a very long aliyah to begin with. The whole aliyah is six psukim long. But the second section, the last four psukim, which are neatly divided in terms of perek, the perek switches after the first two psukim. So the last four psukim are about marriage and divorce. And that's its own mini-unit. Of course, there's quite a bit to say. We'll see how much we can squeeze in. Well, the first two psukim are about a completely different topic. Nothing at all to do with that. The first two psukim talk about if you have a worker in your vineyard and in your field, so what is the understanding in terms of what he's allowed to eat? So if he's working in your vineyard, so is he allowed to eat grapes while he's doing that in order to sustain himself? And what are the rules, what he can do, what he can't do? And here, this is a whole fascinating concept. This idea, you find many dinim like this in the Gemara, specifically in Maseches Bava Metzia, where the Gemara also happens to darshan these psukim in Bava Metzia and Daf Pei Zayin. But in general, in the second half of Bava Metzia, so you have many halachos regulating workers, what workers are allowed to do, what employees are allowed to demand of the workers. And it's an interesting area of halacha because it's not actually the last word. Or maybe it is the last word, it's not actually the first word. I mentioned this in a session they had last year for business education during one of the IAN programs that they had here. So I was talking about the regulations between employers and employees. And the strange thing is that the rule is actually you ask the Gemara last. Because the Gemara, what the Gemara tells us about the rules is actually third on the list of priorities. And that's not my assessment, that's what the Gemara says. That when the Gemara says that this is what a worker is allowed to do, this is what an employer is allowed to ask for, so that's only assuming that there's no local minute. If there's a local minute that says this is what people can expect, so then that's the determinant. And that, the local minig, is only relevant if there's no agreement. Because if the worker and the employer say, here's the rules, here's what's going to happen, you come in at this time and you do this and you do that, and I'll give you this and I'll give you that, so then their agreement is binding. So basically the dinim and the gemara, so to speak, the halacha in this area actually comes last. It's like if you have an agreement, that is the first place to look to. If there's no agreement, then the minig hamakom is what establishes. And if there's no minig, so then that's where the Gemara kicks in and tells us what the rule should be. So again, that's from the Gemara itself. The Gemara asks in a couple places when it mentions some of the rules about worker-employee relations, so why do we need this? Why don't we just follow the minig, or why don't we just follow the agreement? And the Gemara says, well, if there's no minig, or if it's a new city that doesn't have a minig, so then you need to have these default policies. So that's more easily understandable in the context of Gemaras. Okay, so the Gemara tells us that Chazal would teach us a certain principle, and that principle is only relevant when there's no minig or there's no agreement. But somewhat of a surprise, maybe, that it's true about the Torah also, at least in this case, that the Torah is going to tell us what the rules are in terms of eating from the grapes of the vineyard or taking from the wheat of the vineyard, wheat of the field of your employer. But, of course, if there was an agreement between the two of them, then that would override this. That if the boss says to his employee that, listen, you can take whatever you want and you can take for your kids and you can do whatever you want with the food in my field, so clearly the boss has the right to do that. But assuming that there is no specific agreement between them, so here the Torah tells us that kisavo becherem re'echa, when you shall go into the field of your friend, so you can eat the grapes that are there to your heart's desire, but you don't take anything to go. You don't put it into your utensil in order to take it with you. So first the Gemara explains, kisavo b'cher me'echa, what are you doing hanging out in your friend's vineyard? So that's why the Gemara explains that it's talking about a pole. It's not stam, you're not a normal intruder who happens to be trespassing, but you're a worker, and part of the understanding that you're working in this field is that you'll be able to feed yourself, to nourish yourself as you're doing this. And the Siv points out that clearly we've got to be talking about your worker, as the Pasuk says, the Gemara says, because if you're a random person, you're not even supposed to look into somebody else's field. That's the halacha that we have. The Gemara in the first parak of Baba Basra talks about the concept of hezek re'ia, that a person is, so to speak, victimized by others being able to see into his property. And the Rishonim have a lot of different interpretations of what the issue is. Is it that you're doing private things, you don't want to be seen, or is it that you have business considerations that are going to be compromised if other people can see into you? Is it a general sneis consideration? Is it a lashon hara consideration? The Ramban has a language that suggests it's a lashon hara consideration, that any time people are too involved in other people's business, then that becomes a problem of gossip and related issues. So whatever it is, says in its if, normally you're not even supposed to be looking in other people's fields. So what does the Torah mean that, oh, you happen to be wandering into somebody else's field? Because you're the worker. That's what the Gemara tells us. You're working there, and you end up being there. So it's interesting. So we're talking again about the expectations. So this is the expectation that you can eat what you need and not take to go, not take more than you need, because that's going to be endless, right? The same way a restaurant can say, we'll offer you all you can eat as long as you take nothing to go, right? Because once you take something to go, then this is going to be endless. This is something we talk a little bit about in our business class, for those who've been there. So that's not really a reasonable standard, but all you can eat without taking to go, so that's reasonable. But that's not always the understanding. So the Gemara has a drasha that this language of re'echa, so that language normally means your friend or your compatriot, somebody who's got something in common with you. So the Gemara has two exclusions on this word, that it doesn't include akum and it doesn't include hektish. So hektish, we understand. Hektish, what the message is that you're not allowed to eat at all if you're in a field of hektish. So then, the message is that this license to eat the grapes as you're walking down the path, that doesn't exist. Not only can you not take any home, but you can't take any at all, because it can't be done there from hektish. So you'd think, therefore, that it should mean the same thing. That when it comes to akum, so that you're not allowed to benefit at all from the grapes of the akum. So that's the way the Shach understands it. That there's no heter to eat at all, that's not the understanding between the two of you, and therefore not only can you not put it in your bag, but you can't eat it at all. The problem is the Gemara doesn't sound like that. The Gemara sounds pretty clearly the other way, that this drasha is being interpreted in two different directions. That when it comes to hektish, it's coming to tell you you can't benefit at all, and when it comes to akum, it's coming to tell you you can even take it and put it in your bag. So why should that be? So apparently that's not considered to be stealing. That's not considered to be gezel in general. That is the normal approach of people working in fields, that they can take whatever they can get while they're doing it and can take it home. But there's a special chiddush of the Torah that this is the understanding within the Jewish context, similar to ribbis. That's what the Torah Tumim understands. He thinks it's similar to ribbis. That there is this careful balance between the worker's rights and the employee's rights. So the worker has rights, he's allowed to eat, but the employer has rights also, and you have to make sure he's not taking too much of a loss, and therefore you can't take anything to go. And this is an important idea in general, because you find a lot of debate nowadays about issues of labor relations, and a lot of discussion about things like minimum wage legislation and other aspects of employees' rights. And these areas are very important, but it's often taken for granted that the worker has all the rights, and that to any extent that the employer is focusing on his needs, that's some type of injustice. So you have to look a little bit more carefully. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And clearly it's not possible for the employer to just give away everything either. He also has to be able to maintain his own financial viability. So that's what this pasuk is really focusing on. There's a balance. On the one hand, there's a certain entitlement to the worker, and on the other hand, the worker is not allowed to do that in a way that compromises too much the resources of the employer, and there's a limit to how much he can do. So we find that also in further drushes the Gemara has, that on the word v'yachalta, so you should eat grapes. The person who's working in the vineyard is allowed to eat the grapes. But the Gemara over there in Bav Metzia, Pei Zayin Rebeis, has a drasha of Yachalta specifically, but you can't suck out the juice. That you can't do. You can eat the grape, you can't suck out the juice. So again, the Targum explains that it's not like we care how you eat it. It's not like we mean eat specifically as opposed to any other form of consumption. It's not like there's anything inherently problematic about eating it in a different way, or about drinking it, or about sucking it in other circumstances. The problem is that it's going to be wasteful. But if you're going to eat grapes, so you'll eat a certain amount of grapes. But if you're going to suck the juice out of the grapes, so then you're going to end up throwing away the rest. And you're going to cause a bigger than necessary loss to the balabas. So that's what we're trying to avoid. You should eat what you need to eat. And don't do it in a way that causes more loss than is necessary to the employer. And similarly, the Gemara also has a drasha on the word anavim. So the pasuk says v'achalta anavim. So the Gemara says achalta, you eat them and you don't suck them. And anavim, you eat the grapes, but you don't put anything else on it. You don't bring some ketchup with or whatever it is people would eat with grapes. I don't know actually what kind of condiment they would put on it. But whatever it is, you want to put your mustard, mayo, honey, garlic sauce, whatever it is. So that you shouldn't put on either.
And that's something else.
Right.
Eating and not just a condiment, but like
any. Oh, so that's all you're asking, other things of his, you mean? Other types of. Right, that's also an issue that even if you're contracted to work in other parts of the field, you can't take different parts and eat them together. It's also true. But here the focus is on, let's say you want to bring with your honey, garlic, mustard, or whatever it is, your special barbecue sauce that you want to put on the grapes, so that you can't do either. So there you might ask, well, why not? I mean, he's not paying for it. If I brought with my garlic sauce, so what difference does it make to him whether I'm eating it with garlic sauce or not? So here, the concern is very interesting, is that we're afraid that that will make you eat more than you otherwise would have eaten, which is an interesting, you find this sometimes in the theory about diet and about eating and about what makes people eat more than they otherwise would, that the assumption is that they would have maybe eaten based on their nutritional needs, but if they have a lot of other variety that's thrown in, then that entices them to eat more than their actual nutritional needs. So that seems to be the concern here, that okay, we don't want you to starve, we want you to nourish yourself so you can eat during the day, but if you're going to put stuff on it, so then that may cause you to eat more than you actually need. You're going to eat just because you're enjoying having it with the garlic mustard mayo, and therefore you're going to end up being mafsid more than you otherwise should from the balabas. So again, it's a very, very delicate balance between the needs of the worker and the needs of the balabas, and it's a tremendous insight and guideline for some of the questions that we deal with today, the very constant questions that come up in terms of labor relations. And the Netziv continues this point also in interpreting the next pasuk. So the next pasuk seems to be very similar, but a little bit different. It shifts the context from a vineyard to a wheat field. And the pasuk says, Kisavo b'kamas re'echa, b'kataftim lilos b'yadecha, v'chermesh lo sonif al kamas re'echa. So here it's talking about you're going to go into your grain, you're going to go into the wheat field. So then you can pick things out, you can pick out the little ears with your hand. But you can't use a sickle in order to cut off the grain. So what do we care what you're using? Again, what difference does it make? So the Netziv explains that a sickle is a blunt instrument, or it's a sharp blunt instrument, but the point being that it's something you can only use for larger quantities. If you want a little bit of a bite, you're not going to be able to use a sickle to take off a little bit of a bite. When it comes to a grape, you can take one grape at a time, so we're more confident that you'll take exactly what you need. But here, you're only able to cut in bulk, so the concern is, once again, that you'll find yourself taking more than your actual nutritional needs, and that's going to, therefore, cause a loss to the balabas, and once again, that's the balance that we're trying to seek, and that's what this pasuk comes to add to. So that's the first section of this aliyah, those two psukim, and then a very sharp divide, the subject changes completely, a new parak, a new everything, a new subject for these last four psukim. And these next four psukim talk about really a specific prohibition, but on the way to that prohibition, you find a lot of other things. That these four psukim are about the issur of machzir grushaso, about the idea that somebody who divorces his wife and then she marries someone else, so he's not, and then she divorces that guy, so he's not permitted to take her back. He's not permitted to marry her again. A kohen is not allowed to do that even if she doesn't marry anybody in between. But a non-Kohen has this prohibition that if she marries somebody else in between, and specifically marries, not just if she's Mizana, but if she specifically marries somebody else in between, so then he's not allowed to marry her again. So that's at the end. But before we get to that, so the Torah sets up the whole section and gives us a lot of information about Gittin, and it's very relevant to what we spoke about last year, so I'll just highlight some of the key points. A lot of what we discussed towards the end of the last semester, again, not to discriminate against those who aren't here, I'll explain what we're talking about, but a lot of what we saw last year is derived from some of the words in this psukim, as we'll discuss in a moment. Morty, did you have a...
Yeah, she doesn't marry, but she is Mizana.
I'm sorry, if she's Mizana, then he's allowed to marry her again, yeah. But again, that issue we'll get to in a second. So starts off this parak, this pasuk, ki yikach ish isha uva Allah, v'hayad lo simsa chen be'enav, ki matza ba'er vazdavar, v'chasav lo sefer krisis, v'nasan bi'adah, v'sholcham i'beisam. So this is a packed pasuk. This pasuk is all of the Masechta Gittin, basically. And this pasuk has, the drushes has the potential to derive quite a lot of the halachas of Gittin. We're probably not going to go through all the stuff to get in the next few minutes, but we'll try to highlight what are some of the key elements that come out of this pasuk. So, ki yikach ish isha, that we already had in the parsha. This is being stated again. That, by itself, is a repetition of the same idea. That's all of Masechta Kiddushin. And so that we know that there is a concept of Kiddushin, so we won't review that part here. That's from earlier in the parsha. But a man can marry a woman, and we know the whole discussion about Kenyan, about the Lashon Ki Yikach, is a Gzeirah Shava to Parshas Chayisar, that teaches us that marriage takes place through an act of Kenyan. And the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, in the beginning of Kiddushin, there are three ways to do it, but our way is usually to use Kesef, to use the giving of a ring. So, just to first translate the pasuk literally, so if a man marries a woman, and then he decides afterwards that he doesn't like her, she no longer finds grace in his eyes. He has found something wrong with her. What that is machlokes, which we'll come back to in a minute. So then he divorces her. How does he divorce her? V'chasav la sefer krisus. He writes her a book of divorce. V'nasan biyada, and he puts it in her hand. He gives it to her. V'shilchami bezo, and he sends her away from his house. So, like I mentioned, every word of that is relevant to a lot of discussion. So first of all, what does it mean, imlosim sochein, matzah ba'er v'ostavar? So this is Mishnah Maseches Gittin and Daf Tzadi, where we find some striking opinions. And on the one hand, so the Mishnah says that according to Rabbi Akiva, so lo matzah chein, it means that even if he found someone else prettier than her, matzah acheres nahimana, so then that's justification for divorce. Another opinion, the opinion of Beis Hillel, of all people, Beis Hillel is especially striking because Beis Hillel represents patience and tolerance to us in the Gemara, so, or Hillel does. So here Beis Hillel say that afilu hikdicha es tafshilo, that even if she burnt his food, that would also be grounds. So examples like this are clearly very striking. This is not what we normally recommend to people. Right? We don't counsel people, well, you know, if that's the case, then for sure you should head right to divorce court. So what's going on here? So as much as you can imagine, there's much commentary here. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in the Sefer Emes Liakov, there is a little essay about this, where he suggests that both of these examples, that matzah cheres nahimana or hikdiches tafshilo, that they're not the reason, to use lumdisha terms, they're not the simon for the divorce, they're not the sibah for the divorce, they're the simon. Really, it's not the reason why he's divorcing her, but it's an indication of something. So says Rabbi Yaakov, for example, matzah cheres nahimana, that in this taka, I remember last year, we established that, when we talked about mos alai, we talked a little bit last year about what grounds are necessary in order to force a husband to divorce his wife against his own will. And the Rambam's view was that if she says that he's disgusting to me, ma'as alai, so then that's a justification. Other Rishonim didn't agree. So one of the factors that led other Rishonim to disagree with the Rambam is either because they interpreted that or because they thought that what he meant was that she's interested in somebody else. So the assumption seems to be that, listen, if she wants a divorce, it's because she doesn't like him. Fine. But just because she's interested in somebody else, that's not enough grounds to end a marriage. No, marriage is a commitment. So if both parties are good, so fine. If somebody else happens to be better, that's not enough of a justification. So last year one of the Talmidim asked, so it's interesting though, because Rabbi Akiva's opinion seems to be that if he's interested in somebody else, that is a justification for divorce. So why shouldn't we say the same in the other direction? So the truth is, it's striking here as well, right? It's very hard to believe that that's really a justification. So Rabbi Yaakov suggests, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that the mentality is supposed to be, the mentality of a husband is supposed to be, is that his wife is the best of everything. His wife is the most this, the most that, the most wonderful person around. And if he's starting to think that there are other people who are more wonderful, so that's not the reason for the divorce. That's a siman that he doesn't have the proper appreciation, and that leads to all kinds of problems. And that's what the opinion is suggesting. That's a little bit al pidara chadrush. Maybe it's indicative of something. Right? Maybe, and maybe that's a siman itself, you know, that the whole mentality is supposed to be. The Grabiakov's point is supposed to emphasize that when a couple gets married, they have decided that nobody else matters. And that once they start thinking, oh, this person might be better, then that's already a big warning sign that something has to change. And then he goes on to say in the same sense that the idea of hikdiches tavshilo, it's that they should feel like they're one unit. So if the food gets burnt for dinner, they shouldn't be thinking, she burnt my food. You should be thinking, okay, our food got burnt, we need to buy some more. But the whole idea that now they're separate teams, you know, they talk about it when somebody's keeping score, so to speak, and thinking, okay, she owes me for this, I owe her for that. So already that's a mentality of being on two different sides. That's already a siman that things are not in good shape. There are others, I think, who have interpreted that Mishnah with an emphasis, hikdicha es tavshilo, that she's cooking for a bunch of people, everyone else comes out fine, but for her husband, she davka is out to get him, so she makes sure that he's the one who gets the burnt food. So maybe that's also a siman of something. So that's one way to approach these possibilities. Hi.
I saw an interesting answer. Margolius Yalman also has a commentary.
Whose commentary? I'm sorry?
Margolius Yalman.
Yes.
The Rebbe Margolius also has a commentary on the rest of Shabbos.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he relates it to the Gemara, I think it's in Shabbos, that Rabbi Akiva says, Izu Ashir, someone who has a wife who's not a bit maestro.
Mm-hmm.
So he relates it to it. He thinks that you should find another person who's a better person.
Let's talk about maestro.
Talking about like the personality or something. I don't know if
that makes any right, but it only makes it slightly better. You know, it makes it a little bit less materialistic,
less
superficial, but still problematic. And I think, you know, Rabbi Yaakov's Zvort would still work for that, though. You know, still maybe take the two together. Rav Shimon Schwab has a fascinating comment over here, really a very unusual type of comment about the same issue about Matzah Cheres Noah Himenu. And it's interesting, it happens to correlate yesterday in one of my business classes, so the students made a suggestion which I was a little bit surprised. It wasn't what I was expecting. And then, last night, I happened to see that Rav Shimon Schwab says the same thing in interpretation of this idea. I was discussing yesterday with one of the business classes the concept of Lefnim Mishuras Hadin and the question of why is it that if there is an idea that we're sometimes supposed to go beyond the letter of the law, so why is it that the Torah doesn't just make the law that way? Why are these cases, why should it be that we have this dichotomy that here's the law, but here's what you're really supposed to do? Why doesn't the halacha just make it that that's the law? So I have a few approaches to that, but one or two of the students thought last night an approach I hadn't discussed in the past, that maybe the Torah wants to preserve your initiative, you know, that you want to be able to have your own voluntary ability to do the right thing without being commanded to. Which you find in other places, Hanukkah time, maybe we'll talk about that idea in a different context. But so then I saw after that, a few hours later, that the Rav Shimon Schwab, in discussing this, he says pretty much the same thing. He says, this idea that somebody would divorce his wife because of such a petty reason, so clearly that's not a nice thing to do. And in fact, the Gemara right away over there says it's not a nice thing to do. It's a horrible thing to do. And the person who would do that would be a Novel Bersha Satoru. Now, that's the same phrase the Ramban uses in Parshas Kedoshim, explaining what it means when the Torah says Kedoshim to you, that you should not be a Novel Bersha Satoru. So says Rav Schwab, a person who would divorce his wife for such a reason is clearly a disgusting guy. He's clearly a Novel Bersha Satoru. So why doesn't the Torah prohibit that? Why doesn't the Torah say that that's not something that we can allow divorce for? So he has a whole interesting discussion there. It's a fascinating reading because he lists about five or six other things like this where he says that there are behaviors that the Torah permits which he thinks are all really in this category of really sleazy behavior and things that we don't really permit, that they should be prohibited because of Kedoshim to you. And he suggests a fascinating idea. He says, we know that we have these two motivations in Judaism. We have Avos Hashem and Yiras Hashem. So there are some dinim in the Torah, he writes, where we're supposed to be motivated by Yiras Hashem, by Yiras HaOnesh, and therefore the Torah gives us very little wiggle room. There's nowhere we can go with this. You have to observe the din, and that's the whole story. There's no space. But there are other mitzvos where the Torah wants us to be motivated by Avos Hashem. So there is a little bit of wiggle room, that there is the absolute din, and then there is the clear message conveyed to us that any decent person is not going to do that. So the reshus is given to you to decide to step up to the plate and to be a decent person, and those are the dinim where it's the Avos Hashem that is the motivating factor rather than Yiras Hashem. It's a very unusual idea, I think. So if you want to take a look, it's in Rishwab al-Torah on this pasuk. Okay, so there is a lot of discussion in general on what the significance is of these phrases, lo simsochein, ervos davar. The Lavush has a hafabuch chiddush that none of the achronim accepted. The Lavush said that it sounds like from these psukim that this is the mucker for divorce, so it sounds like it only works in lo simsochein, that if he doesn't like her. Well, what if he does like her, and he's divorcing her for a different reason? So then maybe that shouldn't work, or maybe she shouldn't be muteras to others. So that was an unbelievable chiddush that Achronim did not accept, and Mechassina writes doesn't accept that. And Dodo Behuda writes in a tshuva where he notes that the Torah is just giving the context of the way things normally happen. It's not an absolute condition. It's not saying that the divorce is only going to be effective in Lo Simsochein. It's saying that the normal events of things is that they decide they don't like each other anymore, and then he decides to divorce her. But it doesn't mean to say that it's only within that context that it's going to be valid. It is interesting that Nitziv has a comment over here on this pasuk that when the Torah says v'shulcha mibeso, so here in the course of these psukim, so you find v'shulcha three times and v'shulcha mibeso at least twice. So if the whole point was just that she leaves the house, then Nitziv writes that you could have used other language, v'otziyo mibeso, v'girsha mibeso. So he says the idea of v'shulcha, he thinks, is to convey mirtzona, that it's of her desire, and that the point is that sometimes he's going to divorce her because he doesn't like her, and sometimes she wants to leave, and he could have kept things going, but she wants to go, so then it's also appropriate that he should grant her a divorce. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, and that that's what the message is, and certainly it's not only in Lo Simsochein. And then Erev Hasdavar, despite the fact that there is an opinion like this in the Gemara, that it means Mamash Erva, but it can't mean that, because then she'd be prohibited to him completely, and that's not the context of the Psukim. So it seems like Erev Hasdavar doesn't mean actual Erva, it means Ervish. Basically, it means that's something that she does that is inappropriate, that is not right, so then he decides that it's no longer a constructive relationship for him to stay in. So now the rest of the pasuk, I mean, just getting through the first half of the pasuk, there's so much to say. So the rest of the pasuk, there is a lot more to say. So again, so much of Hilchos Gittin is derived from this pasuk. So first of all, the kasav law. So we know that the divorce takes place specifically through an act of ksiva, through an act of writing. The Gemara is very focused on that. But it also sounds like that's really, by itself, it sounds like that's the whole issue in terms of what we talked about extensively last year, the concern of a get ma'usa. That we know, and this is one of the major contemporary crises and issues that we deal with today, that a divorce can only happen if the husband himself does it. And if he's forced to do it, so then that's what we call a get ma'usa, and that's invalid. And that's why, unfortunately, we have a terrible situation sometimes where a woman is trapped in a marriage we call an aguna, because her husband is the one who can make the decision to divorce her or not, and he has to do so of his free will. And if he's refusing to do so, so then we have a problem. Then we're in trouble. So we know that from the several places in the Gemara, that a get has to be given meratzon, but it's not really clear where in the Torah it says that. How do we know from the Torah that it has to be meratzon? So one could have said that just the language itself already tells us that. Because of law means it's got to be his action. And the whole language of ma'usa, to be ma'asa somebody, it means that somebody else is making you do something. And that's not considered to be your action. So that one could have thought that could have been enough to explain it. You do find Rishonim pointing to other things. So the Rambam, for example, the Rambam in the very beginning of Hilchos Gerushin, when he talks about the need for a get to come meratzon. So the Rambam refers to the pasuk of Vimosim Sochei, this phrase we just talked about, that because he no longer wants to stay with her, so that's why he divorces her, and that's how you know it has to be willing. The Rashbam, in his commentary to Baba Basra, and Daf Ben Ches, has a focus on the language of Vinasan. It's a little harder to understand how that's going to tell us, but an example, the fact that different Rishonim look for different words to tell us that it's got to be Meirotzon. So some of the Achronim ask that the truth is, why do we need this anyway? Why don't we just say, like I said a minute ago, that it's got to be his action, so that's enough to tell us. Or we know that there's a transaction happening here, so presumably the transaction has to be willing. So the Achronim explain that there's two different components here. That yes, the get being given itself, so that's one track. But the get is only going to affect the divorce if the husband actually wants the divorce to happen. So for the giving of the get, so yes, that has to be meiratzon, or maybe that could even have other avenues to it. But for the divorce to be effective, so it has to actually come from the free will of the husband, not only to give the get, but to be divorced. And that's a very significant issue. And that has implications, the kula or the chumra, some of which we spoke about last semester, but I'll just call attention to two of them, especially because it's been called into question in the past few weeks. You may have heard, after we spent a lot of time last semester talking about issues of the prenup and about forced divorces and the like, so in the past few weeks there was a statement from some Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael, some prominent Rabbanim, who called into question various aspects of the prenup. Just to emphasize, we continue to encourage and recommend the prenup. But one very prominent Talmud Chacham, who took issue with it, maintained that it's an ones al yidei atzmo, that the person who signs the prenup is, again, for those who are not familiar, the prenup is, that we recommend, is the agreement that a husband and wife sign before getting married, which basically has two parts to it. The idea being that if there is a divorce that has to happen, it will be dealt with in a specific Beis Din that they both agree to, which, as we mentioned, would probably solve 95% of the problems right there. And also that the husband will continue to support his wife at a certain relatively high but reasonable rate as long as the marriage is still in effect, even if they're not living together. And that's the motivational factor. So the question of whether that's a penalty, and therefore a penalty that can be considered forcing the husband to do what he doesn't want to do, that's where there's been a lot of debate. And as we discussed last year, we maintain that it's not a penalty, it's a normal reality of being continued to be married, that you support your wife, and therefore it's not considered to be a penalty. So one of the prominent Talmidei Chachamim who took issue with this just 2-3 weeks ago, so he labeled it an ones al yidei atzmo, that you're being forced. And yes, it's true, the person himself is doing the forcing by signing this agreement at an earlier date, but then when it becomes relevant later, so now he's being forced because of himself, he's being forced because of what he did, and that's no good. So that seems to be a factual mistake as far as the prenup is concerned, because we do not understand it to be an issue of forcing, not through oneself or through anybody else. And the idea that it could be characterized that way would be quite a surprise to one of its primary authors, Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, because Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg was quite machmir on that point and has an article, which we discussed last year, where he explains why it is that you could have thought, actually, that onus la'idei atzmo should work. You could have thought that if somebody signs a contract to do something at an earlier date, and now they're compelled to do it because of what they did years ago, so really that should be considered their own action. Should be considered, let's say, v'chasev la, it should be considered something that is consistent with that. He is doing something that he chose to do because of his earlier pre-commitment. So why, taka, does he hold that's not good, Rav Zalman Nechemi? Why is that still not enough? Because of the distinction we just mentioned, that when it comes to the get, it's not only that the husband has to be willing to give over the get, he has to be willing to get divorced. And if he's committed to giving over the get, but he's not willing to get divorced, that's still considered to be not meiratzah. But nonetheless, Rav Zalman Nechemi would tell you the prenup's not a problem because the prenup doesn't actually penalize him, but just gives him the consequence of remaining married. And if he decides he wants to get divorced, so he no longer has that consequence, so that's considered to be wanting the divorce. So we also noted that it's a fascinating point that this is actually the inverse, it's the same thing, but coming from a different direction, as a svara that was mentioned by Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein used the same svara with a major application in the other direction, because here Zalman Lechemi is saying that when we look to see what's being done of free will, we can't just look at the giving of the get, we have to look at the divorce itself, is he willing to divorce? So Rav Moshe said the same thing with a major implication, Lekula, that Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he said he's not willing to rely on this by himself, but he thinks the logic is true. That has major, major implications if it is true. That if you have a husband who says, I'm ready to get divorced, but I have certain conditions. So then, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, he thinks at least theoretically that now you're allowed to force him. You're allowed to force him to get divorced. Because the divorce itself, clearly he's willing to do. He's willing to separate from his wife. So once he's now handling over conditions, so that's already a side thing. So now it wouldn't be considered forced against his will if you forced him to give the get, because the main point, the point that he's willing to get divorced, he's already established when he said he would do it under certain conditions. So that is the inverse of Zalman Lechemi. They're saying the same thing, but applying it in different directions. Zalman Lechemi is saying L'chumra, that you have to look at the divorce. If he's willing to give the get, but he's not willing to give the divorce, that's not considered to be Meiratzon. And Rav Moshe is saying the opposite, the inverse, the same thing in the other direction, that if he's not willing to give the get, but he is willing to get divorced, so then you don't have to worry anymore, that's already considered to be Meiratzon. We also mentioned that there's a tshuva of the Marasham, which says the opposite, the different thing, that the Marasham says that if a husband is willing to get divorced, but makes conditions, so then already you can't force him. The cases in the Mishnah where you're allowed to force a divorce, that says the Marasham, it's only true if he's not willing at all. But if he's willing with conditions, then you can't force him. So you see, the Rav Moshe Feinstein held the exact opposite. That if he's willing with conditions, then that makes it a situation where you davka are allowed to force him, because that means that he's willing to actually split, and that's all we really care about when we talk about Meiratzon. Okay, everyone find this is somewhat complicated stuff. Everyone following, more or less? Get the basic gist of it? So again, so that all goes to this pasuk. What exactly is this pasuk trying to tell us in terms of the chasa, the nasan, the elosim sochein? What exactly is the reason? Whatever it is, it has to be done meiratzon. Just a few more minutes. Let's try to see some of the other points that come out of this. The pasuk also says v'chasa la. So Chazal understands also it's got to be l'shma. We have the halacha that a get has to be l'shma, has to be with the intent of this specific woman. Otherwise, if it was not written with her in mind, then the get is not going to be valid. And also the Torah calls it a sefer krisus, which we understand to mean it's got to be something which affects an absolute separation between the two. So, for example, we just finished now dafyomi nedarim. So you find in the context of nedarim that sometimes it's a problem that if a man is going to divorce his wife, but say that there's a condition that she essentially remains bonded to him in some way after the divorce, so then that theoretically could disqualify the divorce. The divorce has to mean that the husband and wife are being disconnected from each other. This also comes up in some of the discussions about how to address the Aguna situation today, because there's always a debate when a husband and wife come to divorce, so there's always a lot to take care of. There's custody and there's property and there's all kinds of other issues. So what should happen first? Should you give the get first and then deal with everything? Or should you deal with everything else first and then give the get? So we discussed last year that there are many who feel that, especially Bishman Hazeh, since we've seen so many problems happen, we've seen the negotiations break down and situations go on for years, that the get should be given at the beginning and then take care of everything else. There were others who disagreed, others who said that you should take care of everything else and then do the get, and they had various considerations, some of them pointing to this idea of get krisus, a safer krisus. They say, how could you say that it's actually disconnecting them if after the get is done, now they still have to sort out their lives? Maybe that's a chisaron in this idea of krisus. But you know, others didn't think that was a consideration. And for the most part, we recommend the other way around now because of this aguna consideration. We don't want to have a situation where negotiations break down later. So that's generally the recommendation under many circumstances. Now, also the pasuk says, v'nasan v'yada, that he should give it, he should put it in her hands. So then there's a whole discussion to be had that what exactly does the Torah require when it comes to a get? Is this a kinyan? That the man has to be makna the get to his wife? So if that's true, it's a little bit of a problem, because we know also from Ksuba's topics that what the wife acquires, very often her husband acquires it too. So how's the man supposed to give his wife a get? She's going to keep bouncing back to him. He'll give it to her, and she'll acquire it, and then he'll acquire it. So how does he release it to her if, until he does that, they're still married, and it's going to keep bouncing back? So that's a whole discussion. Do you say, Gito v'yada bo'in ke'achad? Do you say that her get comes at the same time as her hand, which would mean that the moment she gets the get, she becomes divorced, because at that exact same instant, she has a separate identity to have a hand to take possession of it. So is that how we understand it? So this is an extensive discussion. The Ksos HaChoshen has a comment over here where he says that the Torah doesn't actually require that you transfer the get to the wife. It doesn't actually require a kinyan. The Torah just says, v'nasan biyada, you should put it in your hands. It's not about kinyanim, it's about nasina. So there's a lot to say about this, not for now, but there's an extensive discussion to be had that maybe the Torah is not requiring a kinyan in terms of the halachas that address kinyan, but is requiring an act of nasina, l'kula l'chumra. So if it's called nasina, it will be effective. If it's called a kinyan, but not nasina, it won't necessarily be effective. Hi.
I mean, the Gemara is the one that says,
right. It also says it for other purposes. Also says by an evid. So exactly, what exactly is going on here? How does it work? So maybe that's why it works, because there isn't actually a need for a kinyan per se, but there is just the act of giving, and the act of giving creates the divorce. That's how the Ksos understands it.
So then, why is the Gemara out of the question?
Well, we first have to explain it. You know, we first have to get to that. You know how exactly this happens. So the mechanism could be that she becomes divorced through the Nasina, and the Nasina therefore creates the Yad, and that's how she is able to acquire things. So again, this is so that has all kinds of implications. If you've ever seen the way a get is given, it looks a little unusual, because it's done in a way to fulfill all the different standards of what is considered to be Nasina, not necessarily directed by Hilchos Kinyanim per se, but by Hilchos giving, and that could possibly have a different implication. So then the Torah goes on to describe that after he divorces her, so then other things may happen. So v'yotza mibeiso v'holcha v'haisa lishacher, so she left his house and she went to be with somebody else. The Nitziv has a comment over here where the Nitziv writes that she actually has it in the next pasuk, because the same phrase appears both times. But his point basically being that why is the Torah emphasizing she leaves his house and then she goes and marries somebody else? Because sometimes you might think, let's say if a woman is about to get divorced, or more morbidly, let's say her husband is about to die, if she knows that she's going to be a single woman soon, so she already starts thinking about, okay, who the next guy is going to be, or she already starts dating, or she already starts some kind of a relationship. So Torah is teaching us here, Derech Eretz, that that's not appropriate, that first she has to leave his house, once she has to, marriage has to end, in the absolute sense. And then, okay, then she can start talking about being with somebody else. It's not proper, even if you think you know for sure that the marriage is going to end, either through death or divorce, it's not appropriate to start thinking about other people. So in this context, the Torah says, okay, so he divorced her, v'yatzim beis v'halcha v'hayis l'ishacher, so then she married somebody else. Usnea ha'isha acharon. Doesn't have such a good track record. Now this guy, first guy didn't find chayin, this guy hates her, right? So second guy hates her. V'chasev la sefer krisos, and then he writes a book of divorce for her. V'nasan b'yada, and he puts it in her hand again. V'sholcha mi'beiso, and he sends her out of his house. Or maybe he dies. It ends either way, either divorce or death. Asher lacha lalisha. This man who took her for a wife, so that marriage ends. So after that marriage ends, lo yuchol b'ayla harishon asher shulcha lashuv v'kachta liyosol lisha achrei asher hu tamak ki soeva hi lefnei Hashem lo sachti es haaretz asher Hashem lokecha nosem l'cho nachla. So if the second marriage ends, she's not allowed to go back to the first husband. So there is a fascinating discussion. I think we mentioned in a parsha share last year, I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, I guess it would be in the beginning of the Sefer Shmos, that there is a discussion, there's a pasuk in Chagai, that the pasuk refers to the second Beis HaMikdash as the Bayis HaAchron, Godliya Kvod Bayis HaAchron and Bayis HaRishon, something like that. That the second Beis HaMikdash will be even greater than the first one. So there were those who argued that, oh, you see, there's only going to be two Bate Mikdash, there's never going to be a third Beis HaMikdash, because the Pasuk refers to the Beis HaMikdash as Achrim. So you see, that's the last one. So there are those who responded that no, that we find in beginning of Sefer Shmos, that Moshe and Aaron are told that if Paro won't listen to the second Semen, he'll listen to the third Semen. That if you Bahayim Lo Yaminu B'Chava Osa Acharon, if they're not going to listen to you to the last sign, they'll listen to the one after that. So you see from that pasuk explicitly that Acharon does not mean last. Acharon just means most recent. And that there were those who wanted to say that's pshat in the pasuk later, Alpiderech Hadrush, when the Jews are told to put blood on their walls to save themselves from Akras Bukharos. So there the Torah says, V'hayu hadam lo'osal habatim, that the blood will be a sign on the houses. So there were those, I think, Baal Turim, somebody quoted this idea to suggest that the dam is an os on the batim, that the dam of the first makkah, which came after the last sign, the os acharon, so that shows you that acharon doesn't mean last, and that shows you that the bias acharon, the second bias called bias acharon, is not the last bias. Okay, a whole convoluted point. So there's a sefer called Hadrash V'Hayun that was written by Rabbi Aaron Levine. Not Rabbi Aaron Levine, Zech Tzadik L'Bracha, who was a teacher here, very distinguished business ethics expert, but his grandfather, who was also Rabbi Aaron Levine, who was a fascinating Talmud Chacham, who was known as the Reisha Rav, and he was the author of a number of Sfarim, a sefer of Chubas called Avni Chayfet, and he was a member of the Polish Parliament. He's a fascinating person. So he also has a sefer on Chumash called Adrash V'Ayin. So he says, if you want to find a clue that the word Acharon doesn't mean last, but just means most recent, you can find another clue from here. Because this pasuk says that she marries the first guy, and then she marries the second guy, and now she wants to talk about marrying the first guy again. So how does it refer to the second guy? It says, Usneya ish Acharon. So, and then at the end of the pasuk also, Okiyomus ish Acharon. So the second guy is referred to as the Acharon, as the last guy. So that should show you that Acharon doesn't necessarily mean last. That could also be a proof. But then he says, you know what, maybe it does mean last in this context, because there is a Rashi, a surprising Rashi that appears in Maseches Yevamos, and is quoted by the Ramah. It's not really the Minhag, nobody really follows this. And the Ramah says that many disagree, but there is an implication of Rashi and Yevamos. There is a halacha called, there is a concept called Katlanis. If you have a woman who is married and her husband died, and then she gets married again and her husband dies again, second husband dies, so then there is this concept, it's called a kadlanis, we consider her to be dangerous, and then it's considered to be dangerous for anyone else to marry her, because the assumption is that it's a chazaka that her husbands die, because two times is considered to be a chazaka, so now the third person who wants to come marry her has to worry about it. So, does he really have to worry about it? So, probably not. Chassam Sofer and others have chuvas to say that this is the kind of thing that not everyone is bothered by, and not everyone necessarily feels this is something they have to worry about, but the concept exists. And the Ramah writes, the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Tes and Ibn Ezer quotes this idea. There's all kinds of exceptions, that if they were both killed by some other force, then we don't assume it has anything to do with her. There are all kinds of exceptions, but theoretically this concept exists. So it sounds like from Rashi that not only if two husbands die, but even if she divorced two husbands, and then she's muhzekis to get divorced, and that maybe you should worry about that too. And the Ramah quotes that view, although he says, you know, many disagree and assume it's only about death. So the Drash Vayin says that maybe you could say that according to that Rashi, that's what this pasuk is saying, that the second husband already who now also divorces her, so then that's a chazaka, and that means that that should be the last husband. Which is a fascinating concept. I mean, is that saying that therefore no one else should get involved because they're for sure going to get divorced? So does that mean that l'chachila, you're not allowed to get married if you think there's going to be a divorce later? It's not clear that there is such a concept. That's an interesting idea. But at any event, he suggests maybe on that level it could be literal. But then he asks a question on that. He says, so then why does the pasuk need to tell us that the first husband can't remarry her? Nobody can remarry her then, according to that idea. So then he suggests within this that maybe this isser of marrying a woman who's been divorced twice doesn't apply if one of the previous divorces was this new husband. Then maybe that wouldn't necessarily apply. You can marry a woman who's been divorced from you as one of the previous husbands, but not two other husbands. So So it's a fascinating idea to explore, that maybe the idea is that she's a chazaka, she's not getting along with anybody, so you should worry that she's not getting along with you either. But if it's you, she can get along with before, so then maybe you could think that you could fix that. The whole kasha doesn't really get off the ground, because even if there was such an idea, it certainly wouldn't be a full-blown issur d'oraisa. You wouldn't have to ask what's the chiddush saying that the first husband can't remarry her. So I don't think it's really such a strong kasha, but the whole idea is interesting, and the idea that there should be some type of a chazaka by divorces, not just by death, but by divorces as well, and that that should be relevant here is a fascinating suggestion, even though I don't think it's really pashup shat or halach l'maisa according to anybody, practically speaking. But in any event, so the end of the aliyah here is emphasizing this isser, that there is a prohibition for a man to remarry his wife who has married somebody else in between. So what exactly is the problem? So it seems like the issue is, and this is something that Rav Hirsch writes about at length, that basically this could be a way for legalized adultery, that if a person wants to just be with many women, be with many men. So theoretically they could do it as long as they make sure just to sign the dotted line each time and go back and forth. So it could basically be a scam. It would really be people just not having any commitment to each other, but they would go through the motions of having commitment. So therefore the Torah says you can't do it like that, that we want to make sure that's not a possibility, so you can't go back and forth. You get divorced from one, you move on to the other, but there's no going back and forth, because essentially that's what it really is. It's legalized adultery. And that's what Rav Hirsch goes on to suggest when the pasuk says, Ki toivahi lefnei Hashem, that this is an abomination in front of Hashem. So he says the emphasis on in front of Hashem, the idea is that as far as people are concerned, so they're not going to necessarily think there's anything wrong with this. They'll say, what's the problem? He went through all the proper process, he got divorced, he got married, legally divorced, legally married, legally divorced again, legally married again. So what's the problem? Everything's legit, everything's legal. So people won't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he knows the game that you're playing. He knows that this is all just a way to cover up essentially immorality, so therefore that's a toeva, and that's not something we can permit. So that's how many understand that that's what this issur is about, that obviously it's not always the plan, but because that could exist, the Torah is cutting off that avenue and not letting people switch back and forth. There are those who come at it from a little bit more of a lumdish approach, and they suggest that it's an extension of the issur of it's not in a marriage. That the same way a husband is not allowed to stay with his wife if she's mizana when she's married to him, so even after she gets divorced from him, they're still a shtickle connected. How do you know they're still a shtickle connected? Because he can't marry her sister. If a man divorces his wife, he's still prohibited to her sister even after a divorce. If she dies, he's allowed to marry her sister. But if he divorces her, so then they're still a shtickle connected, and that connection, it makes it a little bit like she's mizana tachtav, and therefore that's enough to say that for that same reason, he can remarry her after she'd be married to somebody else. But that's, I think, a little bit more of a stretch. It's hard to say that that's the whole story. So presumably the way Rav Hirsch says it, and others say it, is correct also, that this is a enactment of the Torah to make sure that people can't switch back and forth under the cover of legality, and that the whole point of marriage, as we discussed at length last year, is that relationships should have commitment and should have solidity and formality, and if we're going to make it too easy in either direction, that's going to undermine the whole thing. So that's true about the earlier part of the Aliyah also, about the idea that the Torah makes divorce into a process which has to have a certain amount of seriousness. There has to be grounds for divorce, and there has to be a whole mechanism by which it happens. So on the one hand, it's possible, but at the same time, it's supposed to come within a certain level of seriousness of thought and seriousness of reason. And also, we don't want to make it too easy to undo either. They say, okay, go to this one, then come back to that one, because essentially that's just going to create the same type of hefkeres you had before the Torah, just with a veneer of legality. Hi.
Right. So that wouldn't work.
Yeah, I know, that's part of why I think it's a stretch, because it's hard to explain. I mean, as far as they try to explain it, but it's hard to explain why that should be. Clearly there's already a difference. You have to say, now we've shifted to the marriage level, it's only marriage to somebody else that's a pagia to him, but it's harder to understand. I think it's more straightforward the way that the Rifarshim and others understand it, that that's essentially the concern, that we don't want to make it too easy for people to consider their marriage something which is temporary and easily undone. And that's the whole story here. So in that sense, one could also maybe maintain that the reason the whole parsha of divorce is taught in the context of this issur, right? This is an unusual application. This is not something that comes up so often. And yet, this is the venue to learn the whole concept of divorce, is because really, that's part of the point, that all of this is about seriousness in relationships. So we get married because we want to have serious, committed relationships. And even though theoretically it's possible to undo that, but we have to understand that that's not a casual thing, and that marriage is a commitment, and that it requires a threshold in order to undo it. And it requires a process. And as Rifarsh also points out, and I mentioned here last year during the Daf Yomi Siyum, an introduction to Nashim, that being aware of the possibility of divorce is also something which makes marriage more precious and more valuable, and recognizing that there has to be happiness on both sides. It's not something that can be taken for granted. And perhaps, you know, the idea that Maseches Gittin is before Kiddushin, so aside from a more cynical approach of Hiktim Refuah L'Machla, that the remedy is there before the sickness, but maybe in a more positive sense, that the whole point of marriage is that the relationship should be commitment and serious. So too, knowing that it could unravel, knowing that it could fall apart, is also a mindset that could help contribute to the sense of appreciation and the seriousness that's necessary in order for it to be effective. Question? Okay, so I guess that brings us to the end of Aliyah. So we'll stop here. God willing, on Sunday, again, the schedule on Sundays in general is we usually start around 11:45. So I want to talk about topics leading up to Yantif. I think probably we'll try to talk about football on Sunday, because football has got to be before a show.